Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The day Russell died, he posted a picture of wildflowers on Instagram. Rudbeckia running rampant along the north side of the barn, he wrote. I suppose it's a sign of our times that his last written words are in the form of a caption. Rudbeckia running rampant. What a pleasant series of sounds. It's tempting to connect the photograph with what happened later that evening. That way, the subsequent horror is not so out of the blue. That way, the extraordinary has an on-ramp. It's tempting to reach through the screen, place a palm against the barn wall, and whisper, "Don't." But it's just a picture he took before he left the house.
That's Sloane Crosley reading from her book, Grief is for People. It's a beautifully written and poignant memoir that explores loss, love, and friendship. It's primarily about the suicide of her mentor, Russell Perot. The two of them worked closely together for 5 years as publicists. And although the story can be devastating, Sloane is still able to inject her trademark humor. Not only that, she's able to capture Russell's wit as well. She even channels her inner Leo Tolstoy with the very first sentence. She writes, "All burglaries are alike, but every burglary is uninsured in its own way."
I had a burglary. I left my house for an hour on the evening of June 27th, 2019, came home, and there were dirty boot prints on my bed. Things were smashed and all my jewelry was gone. And I'm not someone who has a very fantastic apartment or a lot of wealth. And so this was really everything that my grandmother had left me, my great-grandmother, my mother. And then exactly 1 month later, my friend who I've mentioned, Russell, died by suicide. Really exactly. It was within the hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, less than a month later. And Russell was your closest friend and mentor. What happened?
Yeah, so Russell and I worked together at Vintage Books, which is an imprint of Random House, in the publicity department for about 10 years. And it's one of those relationships I think a lot of people can relate to, not just a friendship, but the way I describe it in the book is we used to swap roles as they do in experimental theater. You know, sometimes he was my boss, sometimes I felt like his boss, sometimes older brother, little brother, best friend, almost a boyfriend, even though he was gay and had a partner. It didn't matter. It was just these constant sort of beautifully shifting dynamics. And we were just extremely, extremely close. And he was wild and so smart and so generous and so inappropriate. But what happened to him, I try to search for those answers in the book in terms of personal life, socially, professionally. And I think the best thing I would recommend to anybody who's struggling with grief is to say, there will be no answers. The questions are worth asking, but you're not going to get the answer. So when you ask what happened, I will never know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your book follows two main narratives, Russell's suicide and the burglary of your apartment. What do you see as the connection between these two threads, I guess, in terms of what impact they had on you?
Well, the connection in some ways is in the title. The title of the book is Grief is for People, which is like an extremely blunt title, you know, which, you know, if you don't know what it's about, you might pick it up and be like, well, sure is. But it's really about how that's true and how it's not. So what happens is after the burglary, I kept feeling like I had felt so violated and so sad and just so frustrated and targeted. And I thought, well, maybe there's someone I can talk to, even online or a group or something like that. But I found out quite quickly that grief groups don't really exist for stuff. You know, I'm sorry that your house blew up, but it was only a house. And then Russell died and there were no shortage of grief groups. And so that's really the connective sort of tissue there. But I feel like loss is loss. And even with Russell, where I very much in this book recognize the difference between jewelry and a human being, even with Russell, I felt this strange struggle while I was feeling so sad, this extra layer of burden of thinking, well, I'm just the friend. I'm not the partner. I'm not the mother. I'm not the nephew. I'm just the friend. And so I was really shocked to find that, you know, it was not that shocking to find out that there were no general grief groups for burglaries. But I was pretty shocked at how much friends were left out of the equation when it came to grief. you know, in all the sort of self-help books, it's like loss of a spouse, loss of a parent. There's not a lot of loss of a friend. And there are books about this. I mean, Ann Patchett's Truth and Beauty comes to mind. So it's not like this is the first one, but it's definitely a question I struggled with.
Russell never told you that he loved you, but he told other people that he loved you. I'm curious, that I found that very intriguing. How did that make you feel? Did that bother you?
No.
No.
I mean, people are, you have to come to people halfway, right? You have to come to everything halfway.
Yeah.
And Russell, it's like he reserved all his emotion and applied it to books, to literature, to art, to how much he loved things that were sort of outside the flesh and bone realm. And he wasn't really that effusive or emotive with the people he loved. I mean, when his partner turned 50, you know, we all signed some group book for the partner, and, you know, people wrote long messages like it was a yearbook, and Russell wrote something like happy birthday. You know, and it's not, does that mean that there's no love there? Of course it doesn't. It's just that it was hard for him to express it, I think, to the people he loved the most. And that is not uncommon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very well said. And he was also very playful with a lot of the back and forth when you were both working at Vintage at Random House, wasn't he? He'd send you texts from your dog, supposedly, right?
Oh, wow. I have to huge fact check here. A cat.
A cat. Yeah, that was wrong.
Okay. Yeah. No, but I think the thing is, it's like, I mean, in some ways, it was a dream office relationship. It's the kind that you see on TV. It's the kind you see in the movies where you're like, you know, and I don't actually really love the phrase work husband or work wife. I think it's got odd sort of weird permutations or mutations that it doesn't intend to have. It was like we were just a pair of salt and pepper shakers. You know, we were just extremely close. And he was incredibly impish and mischievous. And what you're referring to is when he would send me emails from an account he created for my cat saying things like, dear mommy, how come you didn't come home last night? You know, dear mommy, how come you're wearing the same outfit 2 days in the row?
Yeah. Interesting about you use the analogy of salt and pepper shakers, and of course, S for Sloan and P for Perot.
Oh, look at that. I thought you were going to say, I do describe him in the beginning as having salt and pepper hair, which he eventually had. I think that, yeah, I tried to, it's really hard to write one of these books.
Oh, I can imagine it would.
Of course, I think my book is like, you know, a special snowflake, sure. But I don't think I'm cracking open a new genre. You know, I'm not Capote. But it's hard to figure out how to do it. And the struggle is, how do you do it while making people understand that this is about their grief too? This is about what happened. And it's also just a story that has suspense to it because of the burglary and what happens with that. And how do you do it without sort of force feeding the person you loved down a reader's throat with description and say, you know, oh, love this person exactly as I did. That seemed to be the trick of this book. That was really the difficulty of saying, the goal is to say, this is what I went through, and perhaps you have also had this experience. You know, this is the goal of all literature, right? Is to sort of only connect, but not to say, you know, aren't you sad you didn't know him? And if that's a side effect of reading the book, that's wonderful for me personally. But it's really hard to do while writing it.
I can imagine, yeah. I was surprised to learn that you think you could use some work on getting to the point in nonfiction, because personally, I think your EFP, energy, flow, and pace is great. Is it possible that you're just being too critical of your own work?
I've never heard EFP for a split second. I thought that was like a Myers-Briggs personality.
Yeah, no, I got it from CBC when it was still in Canada.
Okay.
I got it from
Canadian
Broadcasting Corporation. EFP, energy, flow, and pace.
Yeah.
And the other catchphrase they had was broaden the oral landscape.
Oh, wow.
You've got to have a broad oral landscape.
It's the only kind of landscape I've ever wanted. It's a broad one. But exactly. It's what I think about all the time. No, do I think I'm being too hard on myself? No. To say that I could use work on something doesn't necessarily mean I'm bad at it. It means that I want to get better.
Yeah.
So if I have like a major flaw in my writing, I think, I mean, not to discourage people from buying my novels, but I do think I have an issue with pacing in fiction, but not in nonfiction, no. I mean, I just know there's certain strengths to both, but I think that's perfectly okay to say. And in fact, I think there's a danger in not saying it. I'm not trying to sound excessively self-critical or puritanical or anything like that. You should always find a flaw in mm-hmm. how you write or your own writing, as much as you should also find joy, as much as you should also have those moments where you write something, you step away from the computer or your desk and you're like, God, I'm good. Really mm-hmm. good. Mm-hmm. And then even if you wake up the next morning and think, not so much, it's important to have both of those moments. So I don't think I'm being too hard on myself now.
No, that's good, because you shouldn't be too hard on yourself. You loosely structured Grief is for People around Elizabeth Cooper Ross's five stages of grief: denial, mm-hmm. anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Can you talk a bit about why you did that? I mean, I think it's kind of obvious why, because those were all things you were going through, but there's probably a little more to it than that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked, which makes me sound like such a politician. I'm so happy you asked that, Bob. Well, I think of the answer. But no, I think that a couple things are, I messed with them a little bit. So they're out of order. I believe that anger and depression are reversed, or depression and bargaining, something is swapped. And then also, because it's a book, the last section is not acceptance, but afterward, which works out well. What happened really, I was going to leave the stages alone, even though the book was shaping up to be about five parts, which separates it from, you know, I've written three books of narrative nonfiction, of essays that are, you know, thematically connected and have a common denominator of myself, but they're not, this is really one whole book. So it really, these five parts are not essays, but chapters. And so I already kind of knew that. And then what happened is that with the burglary, I got a lead on where some of my jewelry might be. And that overlapped with the stage of grief that would approximately, and, you know, obviously they're all blurry, that, you know, these stages come and go, but that would approximately overlap with bargaining. And I'm like, this is too perfect. I actually am trying to get something back while I think I can get something else back. And so it's sort of the concrete nature of the story and the theme of the story kind of laid over each other perfectly, like a picnic blanket, you know, that just sort of mm-hmm. settles on that first try. And the rest of the book almost fell into place after that, when I realized where it was going, depression, anger, it all just sort of worked out. Someone once told me that those stages, I should really look this up, having written a book on grief before I start getting on the radio. But someone once told me that, and it made so much more sense, because there's been such a sort of revolt or debunking of those stages as orderly or necessary even. I think that they're for the dying person. I don't think they're for me or you. And then if you think of them that way, well, it makes a lot more sense, doesn't it?
It does.
About acceptance of what's going to happen, bargaining, maybe this won't happen to me. It all feels a lot cleaner and a lot neater than it does for the people who are grieving.
Mm, very well said. That's an excellent point. How long did it take you to go through all five stages, or are you still experiencing them?
I think everybody experiences grief forever.
Yeah.
First of all, you know everything you need to know, I think, in like the fourth grade. It's in all the platitudes. And then you just have to spend the rest of your life developing these sort of experiential bullet points. Like, you can't judge a book by its cover. Oh, the only way out is through. And then you spend the rest of your life being like, oh, yeah. And what happens with grief, and I think it's well known, it doesn't shrink. What happens is the rest of your life and the world grows around it and becomes a bigger and bigger container. So part of the reason why my last chapter is called Afterward and not Acceptance is because I don't really accept anything that happened.
Hmm. Yeah. Excellent.
And I never will. And that's okay. I can live
with
that.
Yeah, that's more than okay. Thank you for sharing that. Those are words of wisdom there. I'm hoping you can laugh more in the future. I think you're laughing. You're able to laugh.
I'm laughing.
In the present. Yeah. But I mean, that's
the thing. It's a funny book. It's just that you try not to. I don't want to. It's. You don't want to freak people out either way. So if I sell it too much, and when I say sell it, I don't mean like in a sort of crass, sort of forced way, but just while I'm talking to people, if I describe it as funny, I feel like it's disrespectful sometimes to the meat on the bone, which is my friends. Very tragic mm-hmm. death. And the burglar is no picnic either. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy that that's the lighter thing. But if I describe it too somberly, I think it takes away from the fact that it's sort of supposed to be a laugh riot. So I guess people just have to pick it up and tell me where I went wrong.
Yeah, well, I don't think you did go wrong. And anyone who's familiar with your work will know that you have a very, very a great sense of humor.
Oh, thank you. You're even able to use it well
and appropriately and fittingly in the book. And
this means a lot coming from a Canadian.
Okay, good. So I want to, on behalf of everyone who has lost a friend in this way, I want to thank you for writing the book. It's a very valuable resource.
It's so nice. Thank you. Yeah.
Sloane Carsley, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Grief is for People. It's a beautifully written meditation about friendship, love, and loss.
This has been absolutely delightful. Thank you for having me.
Sloane Carsley is the author of Grief is for People. Find out more about Sloane and her book at wpr.org/beta.
Kill the Indian, save the man was the motto or the slogan that drove this policy, and sometimes kids were taken hostage.
Coming up, Tommy Orange on his latest novel, Wandering Stars. It's the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel, They're There. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.